Welcome to What Does Good Look Like, the podcast that brings you healthy care experts with unique insights into what good looks like and what you can do to get there. I'm Anna, and I'm co-hosting this podcast together with Will. Why do countries take different approaches to manage an outbreak, such as what we've seen with COVID-19? And how can you tell the difference between fake news and real facts in the midst of a pandemic?
You know, when national governments do things, they're always going to cause problems because they can't give nuanced advice to everyone in the population. It's just not possible or feasible. That might sound kind of petty, but it's a big thing. You know, a lot of countries have very poor health information systems, which means that you could have an outbreak in one town, and unless somebody flags it up to somebody else, it'll never get picked up. If something's not a notifiable disease, it might not get picked up at all until it's too late. So whatever we do to our health systems at the moment, if we optimise them for coronavirus, we may be stopping them from being effective for other illnesses that will happen. So we need to concentrate on trying to make sure that we anticipate other illnesses that aren't known illnesses, they aren't known notifiable illnesses, they are things that emerge. And we are going to have other things, you know. We are going to have antibiotic resistance causing outbreaks of tuberculosis in Western Europe at some point. You know, these sorts of things are going to happen, and we need to accept that and work out a way of managing it. If we do everything for coronavirus, something else will come along in 5 years' time and we will be ill prepared.
In a last episode of the What Does Good Look Like podcast, Sam Stoddart explained the basics of health economics and how the interplay between individuals, healthcare providers and clinical settings affect our health. This week, we continue that conversation through the lens of the ongoing pandemic.
So I know you've done some articles for us, Melio, on COVID-19 and excess deaths in different countries, and also how effective potential interventions have been and some views on the future. You've been a little bit coy in some of those articles about what you think has been really effective and how you think countries could employ tactics to reduce the replication rates. Are you willing to share some of those ideas now?
Yeah, well, I mean, some of them are coming to pass, which I'm rather delighted to see. So I think the thing that really sort of leapt out from the analysis that I did is how different it's been in different countries, but also how different it's been within the same country. So I think the most shocking result to me was that if you look at Spain overall, the excess deaths at the peak were a bit more than England and Wales per 100,000 population, but not a huge amount more. But when you look at England and Wales, those deaths were all over the country. You know, the peak occurred pretty much simultaneously across the country. When you look at Spain, a large parts of Spain were effectively not COVID hotspots at all. You know, there were very small numbers of excess deaths, if any. But the places that had COVID outbreaks in Spain had absolutely horrific COVID outbreaks. Now, that tells me a few things. The first is that if you're going to have an outbreak, you might just have an outbreak. There may be nothing that you can do to stop an outbreak that you would be prepared to do. So we've seen lots of different approaches to lockdown, as it's become called. The main thing you can do is that basic health surveillance, like really tedious, hard work of good public health. In the UK, we've got directors of public health locally. We've got national surveillance, but there's also transnational surveillance. At the moment, that transnational surveillance has often been focused on influenza, but it's not just influenza. They've always looked at what we call zoonotic illnesses, so illnesses that pass between animals and humans. And that surveillance is pretty much the only way you can stop stuff. You are going to get the transmission of illness, particularly things like coronavirus, where the symptoms initially are pretty nonspecific. You're going to get those transmitting across the world. And what you see, I guess in Spain, what you see, it's like wildfire. You see little outbreaks of fire. You see little outbreaks all over the place. And if you're very unlucky, you get multiple outbreaks in a small enough area that those outbreaks sort of merge together and you get this sudden overpowering forest fire equivalent, you know, like a massive outbreak. It sort of looks like that's what's happened. And the way to prevent that is to enable localized lockdown. So in Germany, it looks like the individual states probably made decisions before the national government did. And that's not a criticism of the national government. That's the way that the German system is designed. You know, they have a federalized approach to things, and the individual states within Germany are able to do things like stop sporting events from happening. And they did that, although Germany has some very strange death statistics, as we sort of found. In the UK, or in England and Wales, we really need support for those, that monitoring. So you want localized monitoring and you want national monitoring. How do you do those together? You know, because if you focus on localized monitoring, then the benefits are that a director of public health, or whatever the equivalent is in your given country, locally will know the population a lot better, will know the risk places, the places where people are working in close proximity to each other, the sporting venues where distancing is not going to happen, the music venues, things like that. They're going to understand that risk and they're going to be able to talk to people locally to manage it. The flip side is that they are not going to have the resources to understand stuff coming in from outside. They're probably not going to have the information systems to easily aggregate data from elsewhere, and they might not have the expertise to use that data if it's available. So you need to have a way of integrating the national and local models. That might sound kind of petty, but it's a big thing. You know, a lot of countries have very poor health information systems, which means that you could have an outbreak in one town, and unless somebody flags it up to somebody else, it'll never get picked up. If something's not a notifiable disease, it might not get picked up at all until it's too late. So whatever we do to our health systems at the moment, if we optimize them for coronavirus, we may be stopping them from being effective for other illnesses that will happen. So we need to concentrate on trying to make sure that we anticipate other illnesses that aren't known illnesses, they aren't known notifiable illnesses, they are things that emerge. And we do that by having national and transnational organisations that support local organisations to have better information systems that integrate together, where the data is in a standardised format that can be shared quickly, so that it can be used locally and nationally simultaneously, so you don't have a competition between different organisations trying to get their data, which has definitely happened with coronavirus. The other thing I'd say is about the way surveillance happens. We've got used in other systems to having sensors all over the place. You know, sensing is something that's really come on in the last sort of 10 years or so. And there are some cool things that are happening now about things like detecting evidence of coronavirus in sewage, which shows up before anyone's showing symptoms. Now, I don't actually know how robust the evidence base has been on that, but it definitely works for things like drug outbreaks, you know, outbreaks of people using particular types of pharmaceuticals illegally. So we can monitor how much cocaine usage there is in an area by monitoring the sewage from that area. And that's very useful for public health officials because they can then tailor locally what they need and adjust things, you know. So I would love to see, you know, there's where I live, there are screens up all over the place. So that you can go into a shop and the staff are protected. Imagine if those screens could be put up when a signal came through that there is a flu outbreak imminent, just a normal flu outbreak or a particularly nasty cold or whatever, and people could choose to put those screens up. That would be a wonderful thing because it would reduce that annual burden on the healthcare system, but also on people. You know, and make things a little bit easier for them.
Well, that's quite interesting. I guess you can imagine quite a few applications of that sort of thinking.
But you were thinking that rather than having them up constantly all the time, it's like an alarm signal in a way that people should be more cautious, as opposed to having them up all the time and people just get used to it.
Yeah, it's very wearing for people to physical distancing, really, it's not social distancing, is incredibly challenging for people. And most health protection measures are challenging. So if you think about, I remember there was an outbreak of, I think it was syphilis in the elderly population. It must have been a decade or so ago that I was told about by one of the directors of public health. And these sorts of things can happen quite easily. Now that data, that's very sensitive data. You're talking about people having sexually transmitted diseases. You don't want that information to be sort of too freely available. But perhaps in the past, we've been overly concerned about the availability of that data. You know, as long as it's appropriately anonymized, it should be shared, because if there's an outbreak in one area, these things can transfer all over the place. Some directors of public health are going to have problems with STDs because of the nature of their area. Some of them are going to have problems with drug use. Some are going to have problems with influenza and things like that. All of these are very different. And the ability to use different measures in different areas, but also use them quite flexibly so that people aren't continually feeling like they're under siege, but are aware that there is something going on and are able to act, make sensible decisions, but are also expected to make those sensible decisions rather than relying on a national government telling you, you know, when national governments do things, they're always going to cause problems because they can't give nuanced advice to everyone in the population. It's just not possible or feasible. And so having something that you can tailor quite quickly has got to be the future. You know, we can't rely on developing treatments for things all the time. And we are going to have other things, you know, we are going to have antibiotic resistance causing outbreaks of tuberculosis in Western Europe at some point. You know, these sorts of things are going to happen, and we need to accept that and work out a way of managing it. If we do everything for coronavirus, something else will come along in 5 years' time and we will be ill prepared.
I think that's really interesting, because I guess that a lot of people think, how hard can it be? Why has it been so difficult to get the information out? But I think this kind of clearly shows that the practical aspects of both designing a system that works not just for one particular case, but could be flexible and work across multiple cases is actually quite a difficult thing to do in practice. And the other thing is, of course, around information, sharing information, but also not just the information being out there, but how do you get the information to people and how do you get them to interpret and act on that information correctly? I mean, we've seen that there are loads of rumors out there.
Yes.
You know, we have the internet, information is widely available to everyone, and still people seem to interpret that available information very differently, right?
Yes. So I guess this is something I really wanted to talk about. I still see people talking on Twitter claiming things like coronavirus is no worse than annual flu. That is arrant nonsense. It only takes a very, very short period of time to get the Excel sheet from the Office for National Statistics in England and Wales, or the equivalent agency in any of these other countries, and look at how many people have died because of it. And those numbers are, in England and Wales, massively greater than even a really quite a bad flu epidemic. So far, obviously, I know people like David Spiegelhalter have talked about the fact that we don't know what it's going to look like after a year, whether we're going to have a reduced rate of death later in the year because vulnerable people have died earlier on. It's a relevant point, but it misses the perspective that, you know, we had enough deaths that the health system in England and Wales and the health system in Spain and the health system in Italy could, and in some cases were, overwhelmed. That's a very, very serious situation to be in. And the data is available for anyone to look at. Yes, it's taken a lot of the press as well quite a long time to pick up on it, because they're not used to this new world of looking at the data themselves. They're used to dealing with press reports and statements and things like that. We need to find a way of integrating all this opinion, models and technical ability and data.
But I guess people are confused when they say it's no worse than the flu. They're confusing numbers, aren't they? They're confusing what the case fatality rate may be compared to flu with the absolute number of people who are dying potentially, yes, because it's much more transmissible.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, even when I was a child, I remember we were talking about how things like plague were not a problem because they killed so many people. You know, Ebola, there have been various Ebola outbreaks, and one of the most fortunate things about Ebola is that it kills people so effectively that it has such a massive effect on someone that they're unlikely to transmit it, or less likely to transmit it. All it would take is one of those conditions to reduce delay its symptom presentation for these to become a huge pandemic that kills millions and millions of people. We just need to be a bit sensible about the way we look at data, but also not terrified of everything all the time. You know, we can take measures to mitigate things. And with coronavirus, if you look at the data, it's really obvious that it's possible for something to overwhelm a health system and at the same time be largely unnoticed by most individuals within that population, because unfortunately, well, or fortunately, depending on who you are, the bad things that happen aren't spread evenly in the population. They tend to affect particular groups, and that's for any condition, really. And we just need to think that we are part of a society and there are other people on us.
Well, that's a wonderful, kind of wonderful is probably the wrong word, but that's it feels like a good natural point in which to wrap up. So I think, you know, this has been really interesting, and we always say that, but I honestly believe this has been interesting.
Thank you very
and
much.
You'll never hear that again from me, Sam. But
No, I really won't.
But for someone listening to this who wants to know more, to get in contact with you, are there any resources online or offline that you would recommend?
Obviously, my website is awful, but it's got some stuff on there that you might like to look at. And it explains, so I've got a glossary on my website, so that's monkeyglandin.com, that explains some of the basic concepts a little, perhaps more coherently than I have done today. But in terms of understanding the data, I would really recommend looking at the Office for National Statistics if you live in England and Wales, and Destatis if you're in Germany. I can't even remember what the Swedish one's called now, I'm afraid. I'm terribly sorry about that. But your national statistics agency, get used to what data are available to you, and become an informed consumer of data. You don't have to be some sort of statistical genius, even if you find maths very difficult. There are organisations there to help you understand what's going on and to take you away from that really horrible kind of argumentative world of social media and even 24-hour news, you know, so you can see things for yourself and compare them to what you're being told. Apart from that, I would recommend, look at the University of York has some excellent stuff on health economics if that's of interest to you.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Sam. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam, for a truly fascinating conversation. It's clear that public health is a complex topic and that the way that we design our health systems will determine what tactics we have at our disposal when disaster strikes. On the flip side, accessing data from official sources may actually be less complex than you think. So do give it a try. It's a good way to avoid fake news. After this episode, we'll take some time off to enjoy the rest of the summer, but we'll be back again in September. If you haven't done so already, make sure that you subscribe to the What Does Good Look Like podcast, so you're sure to get notified when our third season starts with new exciting guests. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback on the topics we've discussed, we'd love for you to get in touch. You can reach us directly by email, podcast@meliohealth.com, or if you make a post on social media, please tag us using #WDGLL. And if you do like our podcast, please help spread the word. You can share episodes with friends and family directly from your podcast app, or leave a rating or review to help even more people find us. Join us in discovering what good looks like so that you and your loved ones can stay younger for longer.